Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone. It's Sunday, February 18th, 2007, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, coming to you from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, former U.S. Senator Gary Hart says when he was in office, politicians didn't use religion to get votes. He tells us not only why that's changed, but now why politicians have to use religion in order to win. And we're handing out a record-breaking nine, count them nine, intersection awards this week, including what may be the most egregious red light we've ever handed out. But first, in the modern world, what is a spiritual protest? The war in Iraq in general, and the troop escalation in particular, have prompted a new wave of anti-war protests. Just last month, tens of thousands of demonstrators held a protest in Washington, D.C., and another mass rally is planned for June. But we've also seen a sudden increase in protests being organized by faith-based groups, with more frequency than any time since the lead-up to the Iraq invasion in 2003. And they aren't letting up. Joining us right now is Marissa Handler, a journalist and activist who advocates a spiritually-based, nonviolent activism. She's written about her experiences in a new book, Loyal to the Sky, Notes from an Activist. Marissa Handler, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, as someone who can speak from the inside of major protest movements, what do you think about faith-based activism? What does that mean?
To me, it means people who are choosing to act in the world out of their faith, really, out of a deep sense of connection to God, to each other, to the planet, a sense of connection with the people around them, and even with the people that are behind the institutions that they're protesting often. The key is actually really dialogue, and that's a major message in Loyal to the Sky in my book, is just really trying to reach out and talk, because something I've seen time and time again around Israel and Palestine is that on one side of the street, there's the pro-Israel group, and on the other side of the street, there's the pro-Palestine group, and they're basically standing on both sides of the street and yelling. At this last protest that I was at while Israel was in Lebanon, I went over to the other side of the street and started talking to some of the pro-Israel people. And as a Jew, I think they were probably more likely to listen to me. But to me, that's key. I mean, standing on opposite sides of the street and yelling at each other ultimately just drives us further apart.
I think I know the answer to this, but do you see the rise in faith-based activism as a good thing or as a potentially good thing, depending on how it goes?
I think it really depends where it's coming from. What I do see as a very positive thing is an effort on the left to reclaim faith as grounds for activism. I think that the right has really staked that territory, and that is not a good thing. Faith is often a motivation on the left. I went to, there was a spiritual activism conference that happened at Berkeley a couple of years ago, the first one. It was more like a revival, really. You know, people were just so happy to be there. The auditorium, which was huge, was packed for the entire 4 days, and it was a long conference. Every speaker got standing ovations. And I think it's because for many people on the left, there was the sense that finally they could talk about religion and could talk about being motivated by faith.
Marissa, you're a working journalist. Do you ever find your career, which is dedicated to objective reporting, to be at odds with your role as an activist and passionate protesting?
Yes. It's a really interesting issue because every journalist chooses their quotes, and every journalist, whether they're recognizing it or not, comes from some perspective. And so, you know, it also depends who I'm writing for. So if I'm writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, it's a very different thing than writing for example, Tikkun magazine. Sometimes it's been a struggle, but yeah, I've definitely tried to be as conscious as possible when in the role of a journalist to be quote unquote objective.
Marisa Handler's book is Loyal to the Sky, Notes from an Activist. Marisa, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend.
Now, before we go to break, we wanted to make you aware of a different kind of protest. It's not as big as the ones Marisa's been involved in, and in fact, it may go away as quietly as it was mounted. But nevertheless, it's worthy, if worthy is the right word, of being featured in our Religious Right Update of the Week. Conservative website WorldNet Daily says religious groups are upset over the new U.S. dollar coins that will come out next month. Their anger stems from the decision to place the national motto, "In God We Trust," on the edge of the coin, as opposed to its traditional spot on the coin's face. The U.S. Mint says there's no conspiracy against religion here. They wanted to provide more space for George Washington's face on the front of the coin, hoping that the portrait will be appealing enough to encourage widespread use of the coin. I wouldn't count on the right being persuaded by that. But it should also be noted that the motto, E Pluribus Unum, is also etched on the coin's edge. Remember, that was the nation's motto until 1956, when under the cloud of a communist threat, Congress adopted In God We Trust as the new national phrase. Still to come, former Senator Gary Hart on what he calls the dog whistle religious messages of politicians. And up next, the return of our Intersection Awards, and my goodness, it's jumbo size this week. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio.
The wit and wisdom of Pat Robertson as State of Belief presents another installment of In Their Own Words.
You know, there's a lady named Greta Van Susteren who's on Fox.
Yeah.
Got a very
popular. Oh, I saw her.
She looked gorgeous last night, but she had a really serious facial deal, and it did a wonder.
Sister needed help.
Sister needed some help. But she got it, and she just looks great.
Yeah. But have you ever seen someone who got it too much, and so they come up to you, and they're like, "Pat, how are you doing?
Yeah,
it's so good to see you."
They've got the eyes like they're Oriental, and you know, they it's all pulled. So make sure you do it right. But that's one way you can go, but it'll cost you $5,000 or $6,000.
And that's In Their Own Words here on State of Belief.
Welcome back. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and no, I'm not here to give out any spiritual plastic surgery tips, nor will anyone on this show be tossing around ethnic slurs such as those we just heard Pat Robertson do on the 700 Club. We will, however, be speaking with former Senator Gary Hart a little later on. But right now, it's been a while, so we're bringing them back with a bang. It's a jumbo-sized version of the Intersection Awards, our very own traffic light at the intersection of religion and politics. First, a few quick green lights. Let's flash them on so their recipients can speed right through. U.S. District Judge John Shabazz of Wisconsin gets the green light for allowing a lawsuit filed by Wiccans against the Department of Veterans Affairs to proceed. The lawsuit seeks to force a decision from the VA on whether Wiccan symbols can be used on grave markers of veterans who were Wiccan. The VA had requested that the case be put on hold for as much as 1 year. Judge Shabazz issued a brief order that the case move ahead and set a trial date for later this June. We hope that this will lead to a decision that gives many of our fallen veterans the memorials they deserve and, in some instances, have requested. Also getting the green is the Kansas Board of Education. The new board overturned standards that were passed in 2005, which challenged the validity of evolution, citing it as incompatible with religious doctrine. We're very happy the board remembered that science class is designated for science, not religion, and by keeping science and religion separate, they strengthen the standards for both. And finally, a green light goes to the U.S. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that this week, for the first time in recent memory, passed the reauthorization of the Head Start Early Childhood Program without an attachment of faith-based language that has been regularly opposed by the Interfaith Alliance and other collegial organizations. We're going to have to talk more about this on an upcoming show. As we move on to our yellow light, signaling caution, we hear the familiar strains of Amazing Grace. Well, it piqued our interest to see that today, congregations around the world were participating in something called Amazing Grace Sunday. We received a press release touting the fact that more than 2,500 churches had agreed to take part in the same-day singing of Amazing Grace as a way to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade, as well as to offer prayer for the end of modern-day slavery. Well, all of that seems very worthwhile, right? Even worthy maybe of a green light. But it turns out this noble endeavor was organized as what could only be called the world's biggest movie trailer. The company that came up with Amazing Grace Sunday is Bristol Bay, a film production company with a movie set to be released this Friday. That movie is called, oh, you're going to be surprised, Amazing Grace, a dramatized biography of the men who fought to end the slave trade. Now, we know that most, if not all, of the congregations participating in this promotional event are doing so with the very best of intentions in mind and may even draw attention to an important issue. That's why this isn't receiving a red light. But look, Bristol Bay should bear in mind that using churches around the world to help plug your new movie has nothing to do with grace. Grace is free. They also may lack some tact. Now, here's a first. A red, yellow, and green light all in the same story. This one is out of Portland, Maine, where a Baptist minister frightened the daylights out of the Jewish community when he ran an ad in a local newspaper promoting his Sunday sermon. The title was, and I'm not making this up, The Only Way to Destroy the Jewish Race. Well, you can bet people were concerned. But the minister, Reverend Philip Andrukaitis, immediately wrote words of apology and distributed the text of his sermon for review. The actual intention behind the sermon was to educate about anti-Semitism, meaning the title was a combination of slightly ironic and totally insensitive. So, where are all our awards being presented in this story? Well, Reverend Andrukaitis is getting a yellow light, which acknowledges the thoughtful content of his sermon, but rebukes the completely thoughtless choice of a title. A red light goes to the Portland Press Herald newspaper, which eventually apologized for running the sermon advertisement, but still, how did it ever get in the pages of the newspaper in the first place? And a green light goes to the several synagogues and Jewish community groups who used the unfortunate situation to have a dialogue about the incident. In fact, several rabbis have said that the incident will lead to better communication between religious communities. And now we hustle to the red lights. And you're not going to believe why we're giving a red light to Tennessee State Representative Stacy Campfield. In one of the more shocking pieces of legislation we've ever given an intersection award, Campfield proposed that the state of Tennessee require death certificates for aborted fetuses. The result of that action, which couldn't have been lost on Campfield, is that women who have abortions would be identified on public records. Campfield's logic for this new bill is, and I'm quoting, we would see how many lives are being ended out there by abortions. What, Mr. Camfield? Did you just conveniently forget that the number of abortions in Tennessee is already publicly available? Never mind the fact that the bill is potentially illegal under the federal health insurance regulations. It's clearly an attempt to frighten women out of seeking abortions. No one likes a bully, especially one who wields his power as an elected official to terrorize his own constituents. Now, finally, intersection award number 9 today is a red light directed at members of the media who seem to have forgotten that there is no religious test for political office in this country. Just a few weeks removed from the whole Barack Obama was educated in a madrasa smear, the senator's Christianity is now the subject of scrutiny. Here's how MSNBC's Tucker Carlson characterized Obama's faith.
Barack Obama is a member of a church called Trinity United Church of Christ. It's a predominantly black church in Chicago that espouses something called the Black Value System, which includes calls for congregants to be soldiers for black freedom and a, quote, disavowal of the pursuit of middle classness. It's hard to call that Christianity. I think it's pretty easy to call it wrong.
Tucker, Tucker, Tucker. And Obama isn't the only one on the receiving end of religious scrutiny. After officially announcing his candidacy last week, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was the subject of a slew of press about his Mormon religion. And these stories weren't explorations of what Mormonism is. USA Today splashed a headline across its front page asking, "Will Mormon faith hurt bid for the White House?" And what about the unsourced quote used in a New York Magazine article about Romney that states, "Let's be honest, Mormons are weird." Has it become a thing of the past to expect candidates to be judged by their words and deeds, not their religion? Surely the mainstream media thinks so and has the power to make this a permanent trend. I'll have more to say on this issue a little later in my Preaching to the Choir segment. It will also raise the question with former Senator Gary Hart. As a one-time presidential hopeful, he knows how perceptions shape a race. Our conversation with Gary Hart is coming up next. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. Our guest says he remembers running for office when candidates kept their religion to themselves. But he also says that all things aren't equal when it comes to how religion is viewed across the political spectrum. He put forward many of these thoughts in his fascinating treatise, God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics. I've read it. It is worth you reading. Former Senator Gary Hart joins us from Denver, Colorado. Senator Hart, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
It's a great pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Earlier in our show today, we talked about the scrutiny of the religion of several presidential candidates. Is there any way to end this particular practice, or are we just going to be faced with it in this political climate?
I think we will be faced with it in this political climate, largely because of the rise of the religious right and its insertion into partisan politics. But I sense in the last year or two that influence is waning. When you say that this did not arise when I was in national politics and a national candidate, it sometimes did. But what's different now is, I mean, people would ask in living rooms in New Hampshire and elsewhere, what's your background? Where did you come from? And those are very legitimate questions. And I always incorporated into my narrative and my biography the fact I was raised in a religious household, an evangelical household, that I went to that church, the Church of the Nazarenes College, in Bethany, Oklahoma, and on to Yale Divinity School. This was not a matter to be shunned or ashamed of. It was just simply not something one wore on one sleeve. That has all changed, again, because of the religious right. And I think that the pendulum is swinging back to a more normal, thoughtful, and sane approach to personal religion and religious beliefs.
Senator Hart, isn't there a huge difference between telling voters your religious identity, which, as you said, is really an important part of understanding who a candidate is, and then voters holding a candidate up to criteria that come out of a particular religious tradition and a particular set of sectarian values and saying, if you don't meet these, then you're not electable as our president?
Oh, absolutely. And we're seeing it, I think, frankly, more on the Republican side, where candidates have to pay homage and courtship to visible figures on the religious right who have major churches or access to television, and they vie for the attention of those religious leaders and their presumed eventual endorsement on the theory that this will deliver them a large number of supporters, perhaps even of financial support. Even Democratic candidates now find themselves in a situation of feeling obliged to initiate discussions about their religious beliefs, where I would think a Thomas Jefferson would kind of raise his eyebrows in surprise, at the very least.
Senator, you alluded a moment ago to your past, and you were reared in the same evangelical church as Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Can you shed some light on what motivates a figure like James Dobson?
I cannot, because I don't know Dr. Dobson personally. We did both grow up in the Church of the Nazarene, which, as I'm sure you know, is split off from the Methodists about 100 years ago on issues of doctrine and practice. I mentioned the irony in my essay on God and Caesar, that the same God and the same church turned me out to be what many would call a liberal Democrat, and Dr. Dobson, a very conservative Republican.
We're speaking with former Senator Gary Hart. You've talked about politicians speaking in what you call dog whistle messages when it comes to faith and values. Please explain what that means.
Well, I think these are code words to suggest that if you have faith and if you possess values, then you're going to be voting for a certain list of candidates. Well, that's nonsense. I call in the essay on those who use these words, including not just ministers, but Mr. Rove and others in the White House, to be a little more specific. Whose faith? Faith in what? And what specific values? If these are code words for opposition to a woman's right to choose, recognized by the highest courts of our land, if they are code words for supporting the death penalty, which many Christians and others do not do, if they are code words for a position on gun control, for heaven's sake, or for that matter, anti-gay code words, then let's put it all on the table. Don't use code words to kind of communicate in a way that those not on the inside don't understand. If you say values, most people say, well, gee whiz, I want to vote for a candidate who has values. Well, who doesn't? But to suggest that only one party and its candidates have values or have faith is total nonsense and very, very wrong and unfair.
Senator, you have said that there are no great leaders of our time. Do you see that changing at all?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I believe these are not ordinary times. I believe you have to go back to the mid-20th century, at least, in the period between the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, when we had Harry Trumans and we had George Marshalls and Dean Acheson's and a host of other very, very large figures who guided the country into a new era. To find a period like we are in now, globalization, the information revolution, failing states, changing nature of warfare, terrorism, climate change, and the list goes on, and yet we're turning out smaller and smaller figures in our political process. And a commission on which I served and co-chaired, the U.S. Commission on National Security for the 21st Century, made the challenge of attracting higher caliber people into public office part of our national security. And that commission included, by the way, people like Newt Gingrich and others who had been very critical of government and government service. But even they are now coming to the conclusion that the security of our nation is endangered by the fact that the best people in our society no longer want to serve in public office. And it is troubling. The Senate today, with all due respect, is not of the same caliber and quality of the Senate I served in the 70s, in either party.
Senator, we have a growing list of people running for the nomination for the presidency. You have either the blessing or the curse of having been in a presidential campaign.
Both.
I'm sure both. If you had all of these people in front of you, what would you say to them about the campaign?
Well, I would give two pieces of advice to anybody. And by the way, John McCain's a very good personal friend of mine. This isn't partisan. I'd say, first of all, find a way to break out of the cocoon of advisors, media managers and manipulators, fundraisers, and get in touch with real people. This is the importance of the early states such as Iowa, New Hampshire, and others. You have retail politics. That is, you're dealing one-on-one with people and not just media manipulation. And I would say not only tell them what you believe, but listen to what's on their mind. Point number two is, describe in at least one major speech how you see the world of the 21st century and whether you think it's a different world than that of the 20th century and in what ways, how you would use America's power to address the new realities of that world, and what you would do to restore our standing in that world and restore us to respect for our constitutional principles and for what we have traditionally stood for. Every candidate for president ought to give at that speech at least once. And I have, frankly, not heard any of them do that yet.
That's excellent advice, both for the candidates and for those of us who will be evaluating them. God and Caesar in America, An Essay on Religion and Politics, is an extraordinary read, listeners. I hope you will take a look at it. I recommend that you get a copy and mark it up. Its author has been our guest, Senator Gary Hart. Thanks so much for spending time with us this week on State of Belief.
Reverend Getty, the pleasure was mine, and I appreciate it.
You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. When we come back, I'll do a little preaching to the choir, and
there's some part of my conscience which has been seared by an exaggerated form of Christianity with which I was reared.
Your voice is coming up next. Stay with us. I'm Reverend Welton Getty. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Getty. And now it's time for you. We share a lot with you each week, but it always brings us great joy to hear what you have to share with us. It's our segment we call Your Voice. This week, we hear the story of Eric Ramirez Weaver. He tells us of his upbringing in Lynchburg, Virginia, under the shadow of his father's boss and spiritual leader, Reverend Jerry Falwell, and the tumultuous impact it had on the rest of his life.
My name is Eric Ramirez Weaver. I'm presently a research fellow at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the field of medieval art history. Two very important things happened in my life in 1971. Number one, I was born. Number two, Liberty Baptist College was born. The reason that we moved to Lynchburg was precisely because my father was given the opportunity to take the helm of the upstart liberal sciences division, which was linked to Jerry Falwell's ministry. Liberty Baptist College had to go through its accreditation review as part of its interest in trying to expand. Because my father was the chairman of the biology department, he became the one who got them accredited from the Virginia State Board of Regents during that time. there was a lot of pressure placed on the faculty to have their children attend the local academy, which was the Lynchburg Christian Academy. Straight out of high school, I was still working very hard to make and manifest this belief system that I had been trying to force myself, essentially, to believe in. I had to admit that there was no authentic faith-based practice in which I was participating, and consequently, I had to move on. For me, that meant spending a bit of time in a food processing plant upstate New York, in which I reevaluated my life and consequently enrolled in a small state school up in that part of the world. Lamentably, I think that the sort of inculcation that I and every other little child experienced in the Lynchburg Christian Academy as part of the communal setting of the Thomas Road Baptist Church was a form of ideological abuse, in all fairness, that the effects of which have seared my conscience, I'll speak for myself anyway, and rendered me, in some significant way, incapable of any kind of faith-based experience. The little newspaper they had would put these snippets of quotes which you were supposed to pay attention to, and one of them really changed my life and has become something of a mantra that I still keep in mind as I'm trying to, in all fairness, find healing with my religious experience. It was an excerpt from Booker T. Washington's book, Up From Slavery. I have learned that success is not to be measured by what one has attained in life, but by what one has overcome in order to attain it. On a daily basis, that quote from Booker T. Washington is so useful for me because I think that at the end of the day, if I can find some kind of humble, sincere appreciation for the experience of others in their religions, that that's important to me. There's tension in my family precisely because I've deviated from the single path which one can follow. There's tension even from me to them. So, sure, they reject the way I look at the world, but when push comes to shove, I reject the way they look at the world. Be that as it may, people have the right to disagree about things. People should disagree about things. The problem was the kind of environment in which I was reared, in which there was a totalizing belief system that left no space for disagreement. Despite the rhetoric, the wonderful ties of love within families really can overlook and bridge the gaps that the ideologies themselves pretend to be incapable of forging.
Thank you, Eric, for sharing your personal story with us and our listeners. We know that these personal tales can have lasting effects on the lives of those who've gone through similar ordeals. So listeners, if you want to share your own story with us, tell us about it at stateofbelief.com or give us a call at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. We would love to hear from you. We come now to a segment of the show that we call Preaching to the Choir. It's a segment in which I share something that's been on my mind in recent days and hope that perhaps something like that has been on your mind too. America is now deeply engaged in a discussion of my favorite topic, whether they know it or not. Yes, religious pluralism is now a concern even for those who have resisted it, criticized it, and outright denied its importance, or just had no idea what in the heck the term meant. Just witness the hyper-media attention devoted to Mitt Romney's announcement that he's running for president. The sizzling buzz is not about Romney's qualifications for public office, but about his religion. He's a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In short, he's a Mormon. Or the focus on Barack Obama's worship in the United Church of Christ. What the heck is the United Church of Christ, people are asking? Well, it's only one of the largest mainland Protestant denominations in our country. Yes, choir, this is the start of a national conversation about religious pluralism. We've been waiting for this moment, and now that America is finally putting their toes in the water, I, Welton Gaddy, host of State of Belief, head of the Interfaith Alliance, an organization devoted to religious pluralism and its impact on democracy, I'm going to tell you all how to do it right. First off, operate under the guiding principle that religion has the power to bring people together and act as a healing force. Think respect, coupled with our great American tradition of freedom. Think about how you have the freedom to worship or not, as you wish. And think about people whom you may really like and respect, but who may do things differently than you. Then, think about what really defines our nation and what we want from our leaders, values, and character. Our Constitution demands that we as Americans place respect and freedom at the forefront of our democracy. Article 6 of that document clearly states, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." No ambiguity there. And the First Amendment declares that there will be no establishment of a national religion, that all citizens have the freedom to make personal decisions about faith. So yes, let's celebrate our tradition of freedom and respect, and let's acknowledge and discuss the many faiths to which people in our great nation belong, for this is religious pluralism. But lead by example, choir. Embracing true religious pluralism means showing respect for a person's freedom to practice or not practice a faith other than yours. We have a great opportunity right now to show the world what a free, respectful, and religiously diverse nation looks like. Please, please, let's not mess it up. Well, that's our show for this Sunday. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. Go to stateofbelief.com to email us. And while you're there, check out our audio archives to hear this and past shows. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. This show wouldn't be possible without the support of our members, many of whom are listening right now. If you'd like to join the ranks as members of the Interfaith Alliance, please go to interfaithalliance.org to find out more. Next week, it's Oscar night in Hollywood, and we'll be in San Francisco handing out some of our own awards, to be sure. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.